Co-op. I'm your host, Matt Tyson. With me is Rebecca Weiss. We are coming back after a really long break from not doing a show.
A really long break.
Yeah. We took some time off for the holidays, and then we were going to, we were actually going to record an episode last week, but we had some technical difficulties, and we think we've got this sorted out now, so we should be coming through clear and recording fine now. Rebecca, how was what did you do during your off time from your once weekly podcast?
I spent a lot of time writing. I'm trying to finish this novel. Got the blog kicked up in gear again.
Nice.
I'm turning the blog into kind of a curated space for writing on specifically women's issues. Mm-hmm. So I'm hosting guest writers, and you know, I want it to be more radical, but not just to be political, because we can do a lot of political stuff right here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
As long as our tech keeps surviving, I don't know whether we need to like give a shout out. Some rich donor somewhere needs to supply us with great recording equipment.
Yeah, absolutely.
Last week my Skype just wouldn't work, and that's actually kind of sad when you can't get your Skype to work.
Well,
in a pathetic place. Yeah, exactly.
How was
your vacation?
It was eventful. It was very eventful. We had a lot of cool stuff happen in Alabama. If you are a liberal who also really loves Alabama football, the last month and a half or so has been a really good time to live in Alabama. And it's nice because these some of these big events kind of give us a springboard to, you know, talk about some of the things we wanted to discuss anyways. But one of the big things that happened is that Alabama elected a senator, a Democratic senator, for the first time in forever. Actually, the last time that we sent a Democrat to the United States Senate, he became a Republican 2 years later and has since served as a Republican. That's Richard Shelby. He's a trillion years old, and he has been a senator from Alabama for a very long time, all of my life, or most of it at least. So it was kind of a historic moment for us, especially because his opponent Doug Jones, who was the Democrat who won. His opponent was Roy Moore.
Horrible.
We've talked about on the show. And it was especially satisfying in Alabama, I think, and not just for Democrats, but for many Republicans, too, who crossed the aisle and voted for Doug Jones and did the sensible thing. It's very satisfying to really see Roy Moore get defeated like this. And I know that sounds, and it's not really trying to gloat even. This is a man who will not go away. I fully expect him to file to run for governor. Qualifying is open right now for 2018 in Alabama. We've got until February 9th to qualify. And I would not surprise me if he swooped in last minute and tried to run for governor or something. But he's a man that will not go away. But it was so nice to see him decisively defeated. by a popular vote. He's been everything that he's done so far, being removed from the bench and twice. He can blame that on government and everything, but this was the finally time Alabama had a chance to speak up, you know, and make a decision about whether or not we were gonna let this guy continue to claim to represent Alabama, and the people said no, and that was so inspiring and so amazing and wonderful.
And you all should be proud, because the United States as a whole is kind of lagging behind you all now.
Yeah.
You know, Alabama chose the sensible Democratic option over the completely deranged, predatory Republican option. So now, you know, congratulations, Alabama. You're more progressive than the rest of us.
It's a little weird. It's not something that we usually get to claim. And 2018 is going to be interesting. I think you're going to see a lot more happen if there's a lot of strong Democratic candidates who are hoping to follow in Doug Jones's footsteps, and very strong gubernatorial candidates who I think have a very, if either one of them gets the nomination, have a very good chance at winning. So it's going to be an interesting election season for sure. But But, you know, it kind of one of the things that I wanted to talk about, you know, in regards to Doug Jones winning is abortion was a major issue in this election. And it got brought up early on. And, of course, we talked about it a little bit on the show back during the campaign about how Doug Jones went on television and he took a very decisive pro-choice stance. And of course he got railed for it, by the Roy Moore camp and a lot of right-wing areas. And you know, of course I disagree with his stance, and, you know, I disagree with the way that he, would have voted on the 20-week ban, but nonetheless, he clarified his comments a little bit later on. You know, they ran crazy with it, saying that he was an extremist, that he would support, you know, because he was in an interview and he said that he doesn't support any restrictions on abortion. And and of course what he meant by that was not that he thinks that, you know, he believes in these, you know, partial birth abortions or things like that, but that supports the law. And and when he's talking about no restrictions, he's thinking about the vast majority of women who have abortions in a very early trimester. At the end of the day, he took a very moderate but very decisive stance on abortion, and he never wavered from that, not one time. He was very open about where he stood on the issues, and Alabama elected him anyways, and that's kind of an interesting thing to study for pro-life Democrats and pro-life liberals, is because for a longest time our narrative has been that if the Democratic Party wants to make gains in the South, and if they want to make gains in the heartland of America and the Midwest, the rural areas, that they're going to have to open up to pro-life Democrats. And I do think that this is still true to a degree, but I think Doug Jones kind of pokes a hole in that, and in the sense that. For some people, I guess the thing is that for some people there is a limit. There is something that they would put, above abortion in a sense. Or you can, when backed into a corner, you can get them to sort of admit the same thing that we have long since conceded, is that this is a battle that no politician is really going to be able to fix, by attacking it from a legal and legislative perspective. No one person is going to go to Congress and defeat abortion. No one person is going to go to Congress and defeat Roe versus Wade. Hell, no one president with a conservative justice in a Congress controlled by his party can even manage to get it done. And so I think, you know, people finally can see that point, and it's just very interesting that experiment happened in Alabama. What are your thoughts on that, Rebecca?
Yeah, it's funny. My position has shifted ever so slightly on how to approach abortion, I guess, in that I'm becoming more radically left on the matter, and that situation in Alabama kind of clarified for me this people may be realizing that the way to reduce abortion rates is not going to be through legislation. It's not going to be through the courts. It's not going to be through electing leaders who claim to be pro-life. And I think, you know, on one side you could say, well, they're not doing it, so why don't we just try another approach? But here's where I'm saying I'm getting radical, and that is that when they try to do it, it doesn't always work out well. I keep thinking about that situation in El Salvador with this woman who was jailed for a miscarriage, and I think about the fact that early on in Trump's campaign, when he was, you know, kind of shuffling around trying to win the pro-life vote, he said that maybe women should be punished for having abortions. And a bunch of people were horrified and said, no, 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 that's not the way to go about it. But then a whole lot of other people were kind of enabled by this, mm-hmm. and were like, yeah, you know, why not? And I've said, in many venues, we've got to stop using language about abortion that refers to it as murder. We've got to stop making comparisons of abortion to murderers, to the Holocaust, to slavery. And people get very angry at me for saying that. But my reason is not because I want to minimize the value of unborn human life, but I want to call attention to the incredibly difficult circumstances, the complex circumstances in which women find themselves when they feel that this is the only choice available for them to get out of a difficult situation. Mm-hmm. And as long as that's kind of, you know, the only way out for them, making abortion illegal could end up, instead of saving unborn human lives, compounding the injustice by creating these situations like the one in El Salvador, creating situations in which desperate women flee to have illegal abortions and then are thrown in jail for it, taken away from their families. So I'm sure we've already gotten criticized for not being strong enough on the end abortion on the supply side. I guess I'm just putting myself in a place where I can be criticized even more. And this situation in Alabama, again, confirms for me that perhaps many others are thinking not only that perhaps the courts aren't where the pro-life fight is going to be won, right, but are also thinking that this people like Moore, having people like Moore be the ones who call the shots on abortion, that's actually a really, really bad idea.
Yeah.
Having someone like that make abortion illegal would not be a win for us.
No.
Not that he's going to, but if he did, it wouldn't be great. So,
no,
yeah, that's kind of my flip side of the take.
I think as a pro-life movement, this is, again, why we, why we defend the whole concept of you know, doing a new pro-life movement in the first place, is because we have to, mm-hmm. I think we've reached a point where we have to radically reassess how we approach the entire issue of abortion from the get-go. We have to completely, like, get out of the box of what we believe pro-life to be. We have to completely get out of the box of, you know, everything that we've tried so far and take a step back and you know, go back to the drawing board and say we need to approach this from a completely different perspective, a completely different way. I was explaining this with talking about this with a friend the other night, about how, you know, there is a prior injustice before abortion. Abortion is not just the injustice itself. And until we address that prior injustice, we're not truly addressing the issue. And I think more people are kind of coming around to realize that. I heard that even from some Republicans, you know, who conceded the fact, you know, actually said it. We're like, yeah, we know he's not going to be able, you know, no one's going to be able to do anything about abortion. You know, they understand this. They recognize that there's a, you know, there's a prior thing, you know, driving the need for it in the first place.
Right. Yeah, and that really opens up a possibility for engaging with pro-choice people who quite rightly are wary, very suspicious of anyone with the label pro-life because of what the pro-life movement has meant for so long, and then it came to endorsing Trump, and then it came to endorsing someone like Moore. So, you know, why would they want to talk to us?
Right.
But once we start saying, we are going to look at this ethical issue from a completely different standpoint, mm-hmm. and we are going to look at it contextually and intersectionally, then it's not just that we're speaking a language that they speak. I mean, that's a nice rhetorical thing. But what I mean is that we're actually sharing a vision. And I think we should touch, while we're talking about intersectionality and prior injustices, we should talk about this relationship between abortion and race issues, mm-hmm. which I feel that the old pro-life movement, as we call it, has kind of not gone about addressing in a great way. And that's mm-hmm. relevant with today being Martin Luther King, mm-hmm. if you know, the day that we're recording this podcast, and with the March for Life coming up too. So I don't know, what do you think about that, Matt?
Well, I think we've talked about this a little bit before. It's like you can't, you know, if there's a lot of people in the pro-life crowd who kind of, I don't know, for me it's always been sort of something that, kind of shows the true colors. You know, you start approaching the issue of racism, whether you're talking about racism in general, or where you're approaching it from, you know, kind of like we do, from a pro-life perspective. But there's always that guy, that person, that someone who brings up, if the Democrats are so anti-racist, why do they support abortion? And they'll spout off a bunch of abortion statistics from the African American community, and then they'll spout off a bunch of things that Margaret Sanger said, and it's, you know.
Yep.
And the problem with that is those statistics may be true. Those things may all be true, for all I know. But
they
are. They may
but not for the reason people think they are.
Right, not for the reason people think they are. And also, there are other issues that we have to address in this world. Like, we can't don't try to curve around racism and start bringing it back to that's not what we're talking about in the first place. Like, yes, those things may be true, but you know, there are a whole lot of other racial injustice things that we've got to take care of as well. You know, there's a whole, you can spout off all those statistics. There's a whole lot of other stuff that you support that systematically keeps black people, oppresses them in a modern society. Yeah. Like, there's a, and so it's kind of a way, and really I think abortion is sort of a catch-all. It's become an excuse for people to avoid talking about other uncomfortable issues like racism. Because no matter what you do, no matter what you spout off, you can talk about extreme racial injustice. You can talk about extreme sexist issues in the workplace. You can talk about all these other horrible things, and people will find a way to go, well, yeah, but X amount of babies killed every single day, and that doesn't strengthen anything for the pro-life argument, especially in terms of race. It just makes you look more racist. When you refuse to address other social issues, and you continue to use abortion as the reason not to address those other social issues, you don't strengthen your anti-abortion argument. I think you dramatically weaken it.
Absolutely. And I think then there's another dimension to that, which is that the way they frame this connection between abortion and racism is to suggest that the so-called abortion industry is preying on black communities because of some, like, sinister desire to weed them out, because Margaret Sanger was a eugenicist and a racist. We all know that. But just because she was doesn't mean that pro-choice people today are. And when you look across the board, you're going to find the racists, for the most part, on the right, not on the left. It's just a simple, hard truth. So obviously, people are not targeting the black community and trying to lure black people to have abortions. I read a horrible article by a former colleague of mine, Ann Hendershot. You know, if you want a nice dose of institutional racism packaged with some faux scholarship, look her up. But she was talking about, as though she'd made this amazing discovery about abortion rates in New York City and how in the wealthy communities the abortion rates were low, and in the black communities, abortion rates were high. And I'm like, ding, 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 ding. We noticed this already because we're looking at structural injustice.
Right.
But she did not ask why this would be, or say, hey, gosh, there's a connection between poverty and abortion. Go figure. Instead, she just kind of left it hanging in one of those sneaky things, which leaves the reader to make a kind of subconscious jump to saying, gosh, these black people, they sure do abort their babies a lot. It was really kind of an invitation to come to racist conclusions. And I thought that was quite horrible, because, you know, it's bad enough when you're saying that the abortion rates in black communities are high because people are targeting black women to eliminate their babies, but now it really sounded as though she was saying that black people themselves were making less ethical choices. And I thought that was absolutely horrendous, because the fact is the abortion rates are higher in poor communities, and there's a greater degree of poverty in black communities, and that's because of structural, systemic, ongoing, institutional, and personal racism.
Right.
So You can make a connection between the two issues there, but you have to go about it in the right way.
Well, it's so only a matter of time. I mean, it's only a matter of time before people start doing that, because, this idea that black people make less ethical choices than white people is not a new concept. Even I was raised around it. I mean, except it wasn't necessarily it was abortion. It was black people make bad choices because look at how terrible hip hop culture is, or look at how terrible look at how many of them don't have a job. They won't, they make poor choices because they're too lazy to work. They would use all these basic racist stereotypes to reinforce their own racism. I'm not racist. I just don't understand why black people can't work themselves out of the ghetto. That's the kind of crap that you hear sometimes growing up. And there's an undercurrent of that. I could talk about that all day. There's an undercurrent of that that gets a lot more subtle. Especially in a lot of white communities, but I guess I'm not too surprised that someone would take the leap and talk about that from that perspective. And that's always sort of been the thing that I think helps continue institutionalized racism is pressing on those stereotypes. And I know that's not a new concept at all, but it's always been an excuse, it's so much easier to say that black person didn't make a good choice rather than to say that this system benefits me much more than it benefits him. And perhaps, I've been giving many more opportunities than this man has been given. And that's the big difference. And it's so hard to get people to look at it from that other perspective. And I think it's because, and we've talked about this before, but it's because it's because of the institutionalized aspect of racism. Right. And I'll give you an example real quick to wrap up. One of the other big things that happened in Alabama, like I said at the beginning of the show, if it was really good to be a liberal Alabama fan, because not only did Doug Jones win, but the Alabama Crimson Tide won the national championship and beat Georgia, which was awesome, and I'm so happy that it happened. So it was a great game, and I'm not going to rant about that for too long because I'll go down a bad rabbit hole. But during
congratulations.
Thank you. But during the halftime show, Kendrick Lamar, they showed Kendrick Lamar giving a free concert in Centennial Park in Atlanta, and for what it's worth, I love Kendrick Lamar. I thought he did a fantastic job. A lot of people criticized the performance. They criticized, they talked about, the main thing you hear people say when they see a live hip hop performance, I couldn't understand what he's saying. He was limp-sync and blah 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 blah.
Right.
But one thing that really got me thinking about is that the reaction. It's always interesting to me that when you see a bad performance or a performance that people don't like on television, the reaction to hip hop artists always seems to be a lot stronger than it is for other musical artists. And that evidence may be purely anecdotal on my part. And if you think that I'm wrong, please feel free to send an email and tell me why. But we've talked before about the idea that white people are kind of bred to look at racism from a historical perspective. When we grow up, we're taught to see racism from the perspective, look at all these terrible things that happened during slavery, during civil rights, but isn't it so great that we've gotten past it now? And, yes, there's a small number of those crazy KKK Nazi people out there, but at the end of the day, most of racism is over. And we're kind of raised to look at it from that perspective, and we're not really raised to understand racism from a more institutional perspective. And from the get-go, our education kind of conditions us to look at things like this. And so coming out of, coming straight into life, we're already sort of preconditioned in a way to see any negative thing happening in a black community as something that is entirely on the black community and something that has nothing to do with any kind of institutionalized racism, and it has nothing to do with any of the issues. It's nothing else. It can't be a structural thing. It has to be something that is, entirely their fault. And we look at it that way. And when you start to look at things that way, you'll notice that I think, and this is, you know, again, this is my personal perspective, that it seems to sort of seep into all aspects of how you tend to view life, you know, because from that perspective, I think you could also argue that in a lot of ways, white people are still conditioned to sort of look at black culture as something that is less than white culture. We're still taught to view white standards and white culture as normalcy. That's why you always say, you know, you'll hear people say, I'm not a racist. I just don't understand why black people can't act right. And when they say that they can't act right, they're talking about act like white people do. That is something that I think is very hard for white people to come to grips with. It's something that's very difficult for them to come to grips with and understand and accept that, you know, not only have they been sort of conditioned to think this way, but even our own concepts of what we consider to be the normal way, the civilized way to act, is something that was set up by white people. And so that we look at anything that doesn't necessarily fit in that as less than, and that itself is, you know, a racist problem.
Yeah, and I think there's kind of a perfect idiom, I guess, for that with Trump's remarks, which, you know, hit the media and the internet by storm when he referred to Africa and Haiti as these shithole countries.
Right.
And people were horrified by this. Some people, like Raymond Arroyo on EWTN, was horrified that the president cussed. and I responded to him, and I was like, I don't give a shit who swears, but I really don't care for racism. Oh, he didn't respond to me. Oh, so yeah. Oh, yeah, poor me. So the issue there is not the president using vulgar language. Oh, my God, did I just call him the president? Mm-hmm. Shit. Trump. Oh, it's not him using vulgar language. It's him expressing racism. And then on top of that is a reality that, yeah, these countries have suffered a lot. We're not going to pretend that they're great places to live, but they've suffered mostly because of white imperialism and colonialism. Mm-hmm. So it's like, it's kind of the whole pattern all over again, you know, the white people doing bad things to black people, creating a bad culture for them, and then turning around and insulting them for it, which, to tie in with the abortion issue, is why, no, Trump is a terrible choice as a pro-life leader.
Yeah.
First of all, because he's not pro-life, but secondly, because he's friggin' racist. Yeah. Sorry, he just is.
And I think we've got to come to a point where we've got to accept that, too. I mean, I think, you know, there's a small part of me that wants us to sort of not make such a big deal out of every outrageous thing Trump says, not because I don't think it's a big deal, but because it's like, at this point, like, we just spent a year doing that. Like, we've established that the president is a racist. Like, we've figured that part out. We don't have to continue to go, like, apeshit over every single crazy racist thing we said. It's just sort of one of those things established. And we've got to start focusing on on defeating the legislative agenda. And whether you're Republican, Democrat, Socialist, whatever you are, I'm speaking to all of you that feel this way. You've got to start focusing on, you know, defeating his legislative agenda and not letting him get us into a war that we don't want to be into, or, you know, damage things even further. You know, I think we've got and because especially 2018 coming up, we've got it's going to be a big year. I'm really looking forward to all the opportunities for great content for our podcast over the next year. Because I'm sure I'm assuming, unless you guys have an alternate cyclist, is Kasich, right? He's right.
Yeah.
Is he up for re-election? Is he running for re-election?
I need to double check that, because I actually like him fairly well. As you know, if there had to be a Republican,
sure,
it would have been him.
And he's a non-insane
Republican.
He's just George Bush. Like, that's the funny thing to me is that, like, John Kasich is really pretty much just a George Bush, like, junior Republican. And it bothers me that, you know, I was a teenager during the Bush years. And so, like, there was a lot of punk bands that released a lot of anti-Bush, you know, punk albums and stuff. And there was all this sort of, like, early 2000s punk rock revival against Bush. And it's like, he had no effects in Rage Against the Machine and all this kind of stuff. And now looking back, it's like, man, if you guys could have just held on for a decade.
I know. I think they wasted all their rage.
Yeah. Yeah, you missed it.
I mean, and Bush wasn't great, but what was wrong with him was not him. It was just the institutional imperialism and militarism.
Well, Dick Cheney, who was the president.
Yeah, that too. But I feel like maybe the note we should close on is to emphasize that need we have to band together. And like you said, put aside our differences that aren't important. Who cares who voted for whom in the last election? We've got to unite. The resistance has to come together. We have to stop infighting, because 2018 could be a really exciting year and the beginning of better things to come if we can just get our heads on straight about it.
And that's really important. If someone comes to you and says, I voted for Trump and I regret it, don't you dare tell them too late. Like,
oh my gosh, no.
Don't do that. Come on. Like, I've seen too many people pull that shit. Don't do that. You got a prodigal son.
No,
those people.
Don't do that.
Okay? You got to welcome them with open arms. You know, get your big ass calf and cut it open. Like, bring them back into the fold, man. Welcome them with open arms. You do not want to lose these people again. Be nice to repentant Trump voters, okay? Be nice to them. That's it. That's all we got for tonight. Yes. Thanks for tuning in for our first show back for a while. Really quick, thanks to National Catholic Reporter for giving us a shout-out. That was cool.
Yeah,
that was cool of them. Thank you guys so much. I don't know if any of you are listening, but thank you. that was cool. Anyways, thank you guys so much for tuning in. We are back on a regular schedule, so we will be back next week. And thanks for listening. Get punked.